One long ago summer. Now, why am I thinking of this? My son Sebastian said, "Mother, listen to this." He read me Herman Melville's description of the Encantadas, the Galapagos Islands. He read me that description and said that we had to go there.
No.
And so we did go there that summer, on a chartered boat, a four-masted schooner, as close as possible to the sort of a boat that Melville must have sailed on. We saw the Encantadas. But on the Encantadas, we saw something Melville hadn't written about. We saw the great sea turtles crawl up out of the sea for their annual egg laying. Once a year, the female of the sea turtle crawls up out of the equatorial sea onto the blazing sand beach of a volcanic island to dig a pit in the sand and deposit her eggs there. It's a long and dreadful thing, the depositing of the eggs in the sand pits. And when it's finished, the exhausted female turtle crawls back to the sea half-dead. She never sees her offspring. But we did. Sebastian knew exactly when the sea turtle eggs would be hatched out. And we returned in time for... in time to witness the hatching of the sea turtles and their desperate flight to the sea. The narrow beach, the color of caviar, was all in motion. But the sky was in motion, too. Full of flesh-eating birds and the noise of the birds. The horrible savage cries. Over the narrow black beach of the Encantadas as the just-hatched sea turtles scrambled out of the sand pits and started their race to the sea to escape the flesh-eating birds that made the sky almost as black as the beach. And the sand, all alive, as the hatched sea turtles made their dash for the sea, while the birds hovered and swooped to attack, and hovered and swooped to attack. They were diving down on the hatched sea turtles, turning them over to expose their soft underside, tearing their undersides open and rending and eating their flesh. Sebastian guessed that possibly only 0.01% of their number would escape to the sea. My son was looking for, let's just say he was interested in sea turtles. We just finished watching Suddenly last summer.
We did.
Made an indelible impression on us. We can't stop talking like Katharine Hepburn.
If you haven't seen this film, we'll see it, obviously, because there are many long rants that go on quite like what Say and I just did.
That make very little sense. So yeah, Suddenly Last Summer. It's a 1959 film, right?
That's right. Starring Montgomery Clift.
Montgomery Clift, Elizabeth Taylor.
And our very favorite Katharine Hepburn, if you haven't guessed from our impressions, obviously.
Katharine Hepburn, who looks like Skeletor in this film.
Oh, she's just incredible.
Her face looks like it's just carved out of wood.
But you know what? That plays into the film and her usability.
It does.
There's a lot of great themes in this film.
I would, you know, challenge you to even name them all because there are so freaking many themes.
It's jam-packed.
Let's start with the obvious
one. The obvious, yes.
Sex and death.
Sex and death. Are there any greater themes in life, Saya?
How about the Oedipal complex?
Yeah, there's incest.
Well,
I mean, it's
spiritual incest.
I would say... yes, it is. It does have an incestual tinge with the way that Hepburn speaks of her now deceased son, Sebastian.
She speaks of them as if they were a couple.
Mm-hmm.
A famous couple. And she doesn't really like to be referred to as his mother, but
no,
she loves to remember him as her son.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme of insanity, madness, because I would say... most of the people in this movie have some...
yeah, there's some... yeah, everyone is whack.
It's that sort of highfalutin old South madness born of too much wealth and boredom. Which, you know, what a luxury.
Yeah, the only the wealthy can afford to be insane.
Yeah. That's really the message of this film.
So it opens on, which I thought was interesting. It just skyrockets right into it. It opens on an asylum, Lion's View Asylum, where Montgomery Clift is a known brain surgeon.
And he's visiting this some southern city.
New Orleans.
Is it New Orleans?
I believe it is New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. From Chicago. So he's kind of a northerner who's mm-hmm. down there, and he thinks that they are totally primitive and their facilities suck.
The facilities do suck because it opens on him doing a lobotomy for as a teaching.
Right.
So there's that open air and it's there's the guy sitting in the rafters theater. Up top. And during this scene, which I just love, the men that are sitting up in the rafters are looking over this railing, and then the railing cuts loose and some plaster falls down into the surgery.
Yeah. And Montgomery Clift just looks up and is like, oh, come on, you guys.
Yeah. And I turned to say, I was like, you almost expect one of them to have a spittoon for their chew. Like, p-toon. They're cutting open her brain down there.
And then the lights start to cut out. Right. You know, the lights that are pointed at the
brain. He's operating on. And then they just flicker out and go out completely.
And then he says something like, ladies and gentlemen, you've just witnessed one of the most shamefully...
No, I think he said one of the most delicate surgeries performed in a shamefully primitive environment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it goes into the office of the head of the hospital, and I can't get over this. There's just fly strips hanging from the lamps right. in his office. And I just go, is that professional? Just a fly strip in the middle of the room.
Well, what would you rather have, circling flies? Or fly paper.
I guess he could just put out a plate of rotted meat, and they could just go to that. Or rotted brain matter.
Yeah, if they've got a lot of brain matter
they do,
floating around.
Because it's in that asylum. I'm sure they do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So that kind of sets the scene for that. And you're like, why is this an issue? Well, the whole reason why Montgomery Clift came there is I think he got a letter from Violet Venable, who owns this small New Orleans town. And she basically propositions him. She says that she'll give the asylum $1 million, a hefty chunk of change in 1937, which I think it said, $1 million to lobotomize her niece who saw something last summer.
And I have to say, one of the things I really love about this movie is that the story is told in a way that cuts down on exposition. Like there, you know, that scene where the doctor's like, read this letter. And then he reads the letter, and then we find out who Katharine Hepburn's character is, and we find out kind of the whole driving force behind the narrative of the movie. It's very well plotted, and you just are instantly sucked into the storyline.
Right.
Even though many of the scenes, I think because it's based on Tennessee Williams' play, are very long scenes, 10 to 15 minutes, like with, you know, two characters talking in a room. But you really are in the story. It's a really great story.
Right.
That really moves along. Even though you're also like, why is this person, you know, doing a 10-minute monologue about sea turtles? It's still, it's very compelling.
Well, the reason why they did do a 10-minute monologue about sea turtles is, I read this, the filmmakers were told in very clear terms that there were some scenes that could not be made explicit.
Right.
Especially the theme of homosexuality.
Spoiler alert!
Whoops!
God, Natalie!
Whoopsie doodles!
God, that's like the most important part.
Tennessee Williams. So it was a play written by Tennessee Williams, and the screenplay was written by Gore Vidal.
Yep.
Yeah, I think we all knew what was going to happen there. And Gore Vidal was very happy with, I forgot what the critic's name was in the early 60s, but this critic basically said that it was overly dramatic, and it was just basically all about homosexuality, incest, and cannibalism. And Gore Vidal was like, thanks. Everyone's going to rush to see the movie now.
Yeah, really. It really is about those things. And the reason I wanted to talk about this movie with Natalie and also to show it to her because she hadn't seen it before today was because there's so many things about this movie that are not shocking to us anymore.
Yeah.
But the movie treats them with the utmost gravitas.
And you get that from the excellent score as well. Ooh,
the score, it just beats you over the head.
It's just punching you in the face, left and right, every time.
As Katharine Hepburn is saying things like, "We went to the beach that day."
And you're just like, what? You're just telling a lovely tale about going to the beach with your son on a trip and watching Galapagos tortoises laying their eggs.
Yeah. But it's treated as though she's telling a story of just bloody murder.
Which is what happens.
Turns out. Yes, yeah.
foreshadowing into the future.
But let's just establish the most important points of this movie, which are, you know, we started with the intro, Montgomery Clift being the very logical, northern, progressive, science-minded character, coming into contact with a family that is just so out of their minds with drama, and really the self-imposed drama of all of the unspoken horrors within the family. And his conversations with both Elizabeth Taylor and Katharine Hepburn are really interesting because they are so kind of in love with their own selves. They love to talk. They love to just go on. They're just purple. Their language is just purple. And he's like, "So then what happened next?" And then they go on for like another like 5 minutes of just like,
"You
would like me to tell you, wouldn't you? You're a very handsome man, and you're very seductive with those eyes." And he's like, "Okay, so then what happened?"
It is true. There is a lot of dialogue where they're just going off onto a tangent, and Montgomery Clift is just there.
He's just watching them. He's so unaffected by their drama throughout this whole movie. He never becomes emotional.
And the language that they're using, like you said, when Katharine Hepburn, in their initial visit, she descends in an elevator she has in her house, and she starts speaking to him when she's still on the upper floor. So before he can even see her, she's talking to him.
And you're hearing, and it's like, "My son Sebastian always said..." And then she descends, and he's like looking around like, "What the fuck? Where is this coming from?"
And this house full of pillars as well.
And she is basically, I think her character is kind of like the perfect half and half of Miss Havisham from Great Expectations and Blanche DuBois from Streetcar Named Desire. It's basically those two characters had a love child, and it is Violet Venable. Yeah. She's a hot mess. She wears white. Because white was Sebastian's favorite color, you see. I'm in mourning, but I'm in white, you know. And so she always wears white, and which is very Miss Havisham, you know, with the wedding dress. And then she has this southern, I'm still kind of a girl, you see. Even though you thought that you were going to walk in and see a woman with a ear trumpet. Well, I have that to look forward to. And then she says, "Life is a thief, you see. Life steals everything." Things like that. It's just great.
And then it follows from there, and you're thinking like, she's quirky. She takes him by the arm, leads him out into her garden, Sebastian's garden, which just happens to be a jungle of carnivorous plants.
Yeah, they walk out there, and it's like a scene out of Jurassic Park.
Absolutely.
In black and white.
Yeah. You're just waiting.
You're waiting.
We're just looking like,
for a raptor.
And like Montgomery Clift, like he just comes down the stairs. I'm like, "Don't walk out into that garden alone." You just expect to see like Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh,
just
totally.
Came to mind. "Feed me, feed me." Just this giant pod with teeth just enclose him. Or him being carried away by vines.
It's very, it made me think about all of the Anne Rice novels that I've read and all of the scenes that I feel like she just watched suddenly last summer and then took.
It's so jam-packed. Like, this movie, it's such a confluence of imagery and, like we said already, themes. But then you're just like, the further it goes, and then you're right, it goes into that sort of like very hot, human, southern sort of craziness.
Mm-hmm.
That Tennessee Williams just can't get away from.
Yeah. And I think because of the themes here, because they are so mythic in the sense that, you know, we're dealing with sex, death, family,
mm-hmm.
and my favorite theme of the film, which I think we could unpack for days, which is punishment of sexuality by this sort of being swarmed and devoured.
Right.
And that maybe that is a metaphor for sexuality in this film. The idea of nature swarming one creature and devouring
that it. Is different because, or
no that, is... that that is kind of the that's the metaphor for sexuality, where it's just this uncontrollable force of nature.
Oh, I see.
And
why are you fighting?
And it's cruel, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a cruel thing that exists maybe outside of God, maybe, because there is also a lot of talk of God in this movie, which kind of surprises me, because the other Tennessee Williams plays that I'm familiar with, they don't really go to a spiritual metaphysical mm-hmm. place. And this movie, man, they just really go there.
But it's never talked in a way when people see God, it's always in a way where there's some, it's foreboding.
It's not like a Christian
no.
God. It's really like a creator. It's kind of like a malevolent creator.
Yeah. And absolutely. Following what Say was saying about the swarms of people, how that unfolds in the story is Sebastian and his mother always go on trips together in the summertime.
Yeah. We have to explain this. This is the key.
They always go on trips together in the summertime. And last summer, suddenly, Sebastian took his cousin Kathy instead. And Kathy is insane because she saw her cousin die suddenly last summer. Also, that those words are said too much throughout the movie, as if we're forgetting what we're watching. We're watching Suddenly Last Summer.
It's as though they're repeating it as a kind of a mantra or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost, I think it's supposed to have kind of a poetry to it, although it just seems cheesy because it's the titular line over and over again.
But anyway, so Kathy and Sebastian are now going on this trip across Europe, and you find out over the course of the film what happened and who these people are. Like, what is Kathy's deal? Like,
yeah.
Did she go crazy during this? What's sort of her background story? And Montgomery Clift obviously is interviewing her. He doesn't just go in and lobotomize her. He's like, why do I have to lobotomize this person? He's getting her story. And then we find out a little more about Kathy, where she was most definitely raped after going to, like, a ball. And you brought this up, Saya, where you realized that that's when Sebastian realized her usability. And
right.
That actually comes into play a lot, too. What can be used for gain.
Right.
Like, that's said very often. And Montgomery Clift doesn't think of himself, he thinks of himself as someone who could be used to help people mm-hmm. instead of a user to, like, just forward his career.
And he has a conversation with Katharine Hepburn that's very, it makes it very clear that her idea is using people for her own gain, and that is where her morality lies, or lack thereof.
Right.
And his morality is all about what can he give.
Right. And then she passed that ideal on to her son as well, mm-hmm. which is what happened when he decided to take Kathy, because he realized his mother was too old to go on these European jaunts with him to serve as a lure.
Or as bait,
which is what Kathy said that's what her cousin used her for. And he noticed her usability because she was able to bait and entice a married man who ultimately raped her. So Sebastian's a prick for
right.
that alone. But who wouldn't be with his mother raising him like that?
But the part of this movie that is the big reveal at the end, which, as I said before, now comes across as being really not relevant anymore, is that he was using these women, using his family members to lure men to have sex with.
Swarms of men.
And yeah. And the whole like, you know, mechanics of how that exactly played out are so vague in this movie. Because, you know, I was saying to Natalie, so how does this work? So Elizabeth Taylor is on the beach, and then a bunch of men come over to her, and then Sebastian is like, hey, how about instead of having sex with my hot cousin, you come have sex with me? I'm a man, by the way. And How does that work?
Is he just, like, banking on the fact that they're dudes and they probably are already aroused? That if she's taken out of the picture really quickly, that they'll still be aroused by him being
and
there?
And there's a scene of, Elizabeth Taylor scene where she's in her white bathing suit.
That her cousin bought for her. Very skimpy white bathing suit purchased specifically so she will reveal more of her body to lure more men in. And the scene is at a beach. It's a public beach separated by a chain link fence for a private beach, which you pay entry into. And of course, they're in the private beach because they're very rich. And it's a scene of Elizabeth Taylor being dragged across the beach in this white, skimpy bathing suit. And then the men of the public beach just clamoring, climbing over each other on this fence to look at her.
Which is a powerful image.
Yes.
And then there's the scene of her running back onto the beach from the water. And you see, because we never actually see Sebastian, but there is an actor who's kind of portraying him in these flashbacks where you see him from behind or you see just like his sleeve or something. And you see him walking through the water towards these men.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the closest we ever get to any visual representation of what was actually happening.
Right.
And then at the end, Elizabeth Taylor tells this story and reveals to everyone what was really going on. The ideas that Katharine Hepburn's character has about what was going on, she is so delusional. She says that Sebastian was celibate.
Yes.
That he never had sex. I mean, the word sex is never used, but he had never had any encounters. When then later we find out that she was enabling him to have sexual encounters with men,
mm-hmm.
which is such a bizarre idea that she could be going on these holidays, doing this every day, and then coming home and being in denial about it after he dies. It's like, she was totally in the closet with him.
Yes.
And then Kathy goes in the closet with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it really fascinating to think about the fact that they, in this film, in the inner logic of this film, they're living in a world where they are both in total denial and they must have, at one time, had an experience of Sebastian saying, hey, so, could you just bring that guy over here and then I'm going to take him back to my room on the cruise ship or whatever? Like, it's so strange because they are so afraid of the truth, which is another line that gets said so many times. Like, you can't cut the truth out of my brain with your needle or whatever it is.
Right,
you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they have this utter conflict in themselves, in their own experience. And that is kind of where the tension in the film comes from, I think.
Right. No one wants to spill the beans.
Right. Because the beans are fucked up.
The beans are a bunch of sea turtles. Little baby sea turtles being devoured by ravenous birds on a beach. Which is, spoiler alert, unfortunately what happens to our dear Sebastian.
Yeah, which is a really strange scene in the movie because there's this whole, it's almost like not worth explaining the whole band thing, the band of children who play instruments, hunt him down and then eat him.
Yeah, they follow him through the streets, the swarming again, they swarm him, he's at the ground and they are tearing him from limb to limb and they eat him. This is all told by Elizabeth Taylor in her monologue at the end.
I really like sort of their acknowledgement of their own sexuality turns them into animals. Like, I feel like that's a big part of the metaphors in this movie too, where, you know, the swarming, it's and my favorite line from the doctor, he says, nature is not created in the image of man's compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that line. I think it's really important and kind of almost like the thesis of the film, which is that the world isn't arranged based on your idea of morality. The world is how it is. And Katharine Hepburn says that is what Sebastian thought about the world. And part of me is like, well, Sebastian was obviously a really bad guy, but then part of me is also kind of like, well, he kind of maybe had his head on a little straighter than his mom and his cousin, because he, you know, he was kind of getting it done. Like, he was doing what he needed to do.
Right, but he's also exploiting the people closest to him.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, he's clearly a psychopath. But but he also, you know, in Katharine Hepburn's retelling of his personality, was very open to the cruelty of nature, right?
Right. He understood the laws of the jungle,
right,
per se.
Right.
But he's still a human, you know? He should still have that compassion that it just wasn't there.
No.
And, you know, that's kind of when Elizabeth
None
Taylor...
None of them really had compassion.
I think that Liz Taylor did. I mean, she was really just taken to task at every go here. She was used for her beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Her family was going to sign away her right to just still exist as she knows it as a human, because her family was impoverished. Even though Katharine Hepburn is her wealthy aunt, her family was impoverished, and Katharine Hepburn promised her mother and brother $100,000 if they signed away her rights, so she would be lobotomized.
Right.
And they were actually considering that. So she is. She's between the rock and the hard place. And when she retells how Sebastian lived his life, half starved from living on pills and salads, and telling her he's famished for blondes,
right,
because he's fed up with the dark ones. Like, this is how he's talking about these people that he's encountering in all of his trips. They're not people to him. They're
right, just... and that's what she says in that same monologue where she talks about being famished. She says, he always talked about people as if they were items on a menu.
Right, and he used her just like
right.
one, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, I mean, like you said, it's a fucked up can of beans. And just the image, again, of just how they're portraying these people that are as savage because they're from another country, or they're just something to be used. They're just these savages that they can't control themselves. They must have this beautiful woman. They're just animalistic in their urges. And they're so much so that they're going to chase him across the streets and then just tear him apart. And it's really?
And also, you know, I feel like what this movie does that can kind of be difficult at times is, It takes a metaphor where you have one thing and you're comparing it to another thing, and you're you know, finding things out about both things in the comparison. And then it adds two or three more things into the mix. Like, for instance, with the whole, you know, the swarming and the sexuality, it also adds into the mix the swarming of the mental patients in the asylum,
yes,
which happens multiple times. And so then you've got the juxtaposition of, you know, these so-called primitive natives in these places that they're going,
mm-hmm,
these dark-skinned young men who they refer to as children in a really condescending way.
Yes.
You've got that juxtaposed with madmen, which is like such a can of worms to say, okay, so are they saying that people with mental illness are primitive, or are they saying people who are from, you know, a third world country are mad, you
right.
know? It's so much to unpack.
Or should be treated as children,
yeah,
as well.
Right. It's awesome, really. I mean, it's like, really watching this movie gives me so many things to think about. But mostly the fact that I'm very glad we are at a time now when gay panic is not the twist.
Yeah.
Of
right.
popular feature
right.
films.
Right.
You know, where the moment in the end where the music crescendo builds and she goes, they devoured him. And you're like, oh shit, okay, he was gay and all of his lovers came and killed him in the end.
Or these people he possibly raped.
Right, right.
As well.
Because the primitive children he raped in third world countries
where he's just
ate
throwing
him alive.
His money. Right.
Which, wow, but, you know.
there's a scene where there's a line that Elizabeth Taylor talks about when she's writing her diary, where she just starts writing in the third person, where
right.
she gets like, she woke up early today. Mm-hmm. And that gets you a great state of where her mind is after being used. This is after her rape. And she talks about the world devouring her. Mm-hmm. And that's true today, I think, for young women that are beautiful.
Oh, yeah. And here's another thing I was thinking about, which is a lot to figure out. This movie really punishes sexuality, right? Mm-hmm. Every bit of beauty, sexual beauty, and sexual indulgence in this movie is pretty much categorized as evil, amoral, and something to be punished.
Yes.
Right? Or in on the female side of things, something that makes you insane and a temptress. And right. It's all your fault.
It's all your fault.
And you know, like we were saying earlier, how Elizabeth Taylor is just trapped in this cage of her own beauty. And she realizes that she loves how she looks. She loves dressing up. But at the same time, it does feel like a trap, you right. know? She is so just unspeakably beautiful. She has some close-ups in this movie that are, it's just like her face is like the entire screen. You're just like, look, those eyes,
she's
a
knockout.
It's otherworldly. But it also is ominous.
Why is she punished for this?
Right.
And then her responses to it, where she doesn't always go as a damsel in distress. She's often a little flip about it, mm-hmm. like sarcastic. And you get where she's coming from, and it's just infuriating.
Well, and so what I was going to say is, okay, so I think that unfortunately this whole idea, this sort of narrative device of sexuality having to be punished, mm-hmm. right? Pleasure mm-hmm. having to be punished.
Right.
Is something that creates good narrative a lot of the time. Because there aren't a lot of movies where people just have sex and it's fun and then nothing bad happens.
Well,
afterwards.
You can even see, right, you're right.
You're right.
And you can even put that into these actors' own lives, Montgomery Clift specifically.
Right.
Constantly torturing himself over his own homosexuality.
Right. I was thinking about what themes you think are still kind of taboo that, you know, like how this theme of homosexuality is taboo in this movie at this time.
Yeah.
What bridges do we still have to cross?
How about a woman
cinema?
Who is sexually independent and doesn't face any repercussions from it?
Well, that's what I was saying about tension.
Right.
And how that would actually not be that interesting, maybe.
Right.
Because if...
But why can't she have another tension in her life that doesn't have to deal with how it relates
oh, I know.
To a man?
Agreed. Agreed. Well, I think, obviously, we still have the struggle of getting maybe more than one movie out of 20 to pass the Bechdel test,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think we're particularly sensitive to female roles and female conversation and themes in film because we are women, FYI.
I would hope they picked up on that by now.
I'd like to think that our listeners are a group of very forward-thinking, progressive people who wouldn't gender us based on our voices alone. Today, Natalie showed me that you can make up...
No, not here, Saya.
Never mind, we'll save that for the twist. Anyway, but...
But sexually independent, yeah, and you know, I think that they... I was reading about... I haven't seen this movie with Diane Keaton, Mr. Goodbar, Looking for Mr. Goodbar. She's a school teacher that goes to bars and she has a lot of one-night stands with men. And mm-hmm. eventually she meets the wrong man who kills her.
When's that movie from?
From the 70s.
Oh, boy.
And I was really into because the 70s is the period of filmmaking that I really enjoy.
Me
I feel
too.
Like it's just a lot of really great storylines out there and a lot of great different roles. And it was the end of like the big cinematic or biblical story.
Well, you know, that's the whole thesis of that book about Bonnie and Clyde. You know, I haven't read it, you know, because I don't really do any real research,
no research
for this
on
show.
This one.
But there's this book about how Bonnie and Clyde launched a new kind of era in filmmaking. And that movie definitely has the early hallmarks of a lot of the 70s style filmmaking that we both love.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
And I mean, Bonnie and Clyde, they were just...
That movie is whack.
No,
if you
but
watch that now, it is weird.
It's very weird. It's very good. But the real true Bonnie and Clyde, just sleeping with whoever and whenever.
God.
Just going on.
Talk about amoral.
Yeah, absolutely. Amoral, young, bored.
Yep.
That's a really scary combo.
No accountability.
Nothing.
Somehow they're both like, let's kill
people. Amoral, young, bored, and poor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Having just a female lead that is secure in herself, that wants to explore something else and expand her life in another way, outside of her own, what her beauty means to others, mm-hmm. how other people perceive that. Is there a movie that's similar for women? Like, let's say, what was the John Krakauer movie? Into the Wild.
Into the Wild.
Is there something similar like that?
Well, I mean, we already know what your point is, so we don't even have to do this comparison. Your point is something that everyone already knows, which is that men are expected to go on quests, and that is a part of the male Western experience, is the urge to have a quest. Women are not. Women don't got a quest, unfortunately, even though many of us have the urge to have those grand philosophical adventures, right. You know, both in our own minds and in the world.
Our quest has to be internal.
Mm-hmm. Our quest is finding stasis in a lot of ways, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what is expected of us, to find a man and to have children and to nest, you know?
Hmm.
And what is the fucking message of Eat, Pray, Love? If not, find a man.
So true.
Settle down.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, granted, Javier Bardem, but he's pretty cool.
No, Saya, no.
No, stop.
Don't throw it
no.
all away for Javier Bardem.
But, you know, it's not any more fucked up than glorifying what happened to Christopher McCandless in Into the Wild, right? Mm-hmm. I really liked that movie,
mm-hmm.
but it is like, you're dying in an old bus in Alaska because you don't have anything else to do. Right?
Right.
And I will admit, I wept when he died right. in that old bus, but I was right. also like,
why didn't you do something else? Join the Peace Corps? Yeah. Help build some bridges?
Yeah.
You know, he donated all of his money to Amnesty International or something like that, and then he just went off into the wild. Right. But you're right. What? You're young?
Because a woman, imagine that movie with a woman, you know, in that moment of, everyone would be like, she's suicidal. Everyone would think that. But instead we think, oh, there was a certain romance to him dying.
Tragic hero.
It's like, no, he was fucking 20 something years old and he was just.
Do you think if it was a woman, they'd be like, what a dumb bitch.
Probably. Probably.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's surprising that our conversation about Suddenly Last Summer has gone into this realm, because any conversation about the portrayals of homosexuality in film
mm-hmm.
are really directly linked to any portrayal of gender, politics, you know, female sexuality. Those two things are linked. And I think, you know, if we wanted to, we can even link them to, you know, race, but let's not go there because that's a whole nother podcast. We can pick another movie to go there with. But, you know, if Sebastian had been a straight character,
mm-hmm.
if he had been, let's say that he had brought a man on this trip to lure
women
to him,
right?
It just never would have worked. That plot never would have worked.
Right, it's James Bond. It's every other movie.
No fucking kidding. The last James Bond movie, I have to say, I loved it until he fucked a sex slave. And I was like,
right, right.
What? Excuse me?
Right.
They're in the shower together. And after she has told him her story of being abducted into sex slavery
when
in China or something.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, cool story. Let's do it later in a shower.
That night.
Mm-hmm. I was like, you're horrible. But again,
yeah.
The reason that happened was because he's James Bond and she was hot.
Yep.
It couldn't not happen. It's like a magnetic.
She was the item on the menu
force.
That night.
Yes. Ugh. horrifying. Mm. I mean, how great would it have been if he would have started making the moves on her and she would have said, you know, actually, my sense of myself as a sexual being has been irrevocably corrupted by my childhood experience of multiple rapes.
Right.
The end!
Do you realize I've never had a childhood because I've always had a dick shoved at me? Because I just happened to be pretty?
Oh, my God. If anybody out there is tired of hearing this feminist shit, sorry, too bad.
Tough titties.
Tough titties, said the kitty. Because we're just getting started.